Once you moved to Des Moines, did you finish high school there then?
No, I was asked to leave.
Okay.
Well, I started a riot in the lunchroom.
Like you do.
I remember they would give us this very specific sort of pale white macaroni and cheese that I was convinced they were cutting with spackle. And I took it and I stuck it on the wall and it stayed. And I jumped up on a table and I said, "Do you see what they are putting in our bodies?" The next day, I went and got my GED, graduated class of Thursday, 1992. It was cool, you know?
It's Maya Bialik's breakdown. She's going to break it down for you, because you know she knows a thing or two. And now she's going to break down. It's a breakdown. She's going to break it down.
Maya Bialik's breakdown is supported by Everlywell.
Everlywell at-home lab tests gives you physician-reviewed results and personalized insights so that you can take action appropriately on your health and wellness at an affordable and transparent cost. There are 30 tests, and you can choose the ones that make the most sense for you. So some of the examples of tests are food sensitivity, that's the one we did, metabolism, sleep and stress, and thyroid. They ship you your at-home lab test right to you, and everything is in there, everything you need to do a simple sample collection. They give you a prepaid shipping label. You mail your test back to the lab where you send it, and in days, your physician-reviewed results and actionable insights are sent to you. They can go right to your phone. This is something that used to be like an elite thing that you had to like go to a special doctor, like for food sensitivity. I've never had this done. And I was like, this is what I want. I want to know. So that's what we did. And for listeners of our show, Everlywell is offering a very special discount of 20% off an at-home lab test at everlywell.com/break. That's everlywell.com/break. 20% off your at-home lab test.
Everlywell.com/break. My and Bialik's breakdown is supported by Theragun.
I'm going to try and read this copy while Jonathan Theraguns me. Theragun, yeah! Okay, sorry. I'm already nervous. Okay, no, it feels good. Theragun is the... Theragun is the... Jonathan! All right.
This is where you keep all your
gonna. Theragun is the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combination of depth, it is deep, speed, it is fast, and power, it is powerful, and it's quiet as an electric toothbrush. The Gen 4 Theragun doesn't just feel good, it gets to the source of pain by releasing tension, and that is so true. Jonathan and I are deeply connected to like somatic pain and our bodies. It's not just about it feeling better. It's about your body being able to release the tension so that you feel better. How do you feel about the Theragun, Jonathan?
I started using Theragun after my hip surgery, and I was doing a lot of rehab, and I found it super helpful to help the entire area of my leg and my calf totally relax. I love it.
Try Theragun for 30 days. Starting at only $199, go to therabody.com/breakdown right now. Get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's therabody.com/breakdown, therabody.com/breakdown. Hi, I'm Maya Bialik, and welcome to my breakdown. This is the place where we break things down that make us break down.
You chose that specifically today. Sometimes
because I have a little breakdown.
You do. I introduce myself.
You want to introduce yourself?
Well, I just jumped my intro.
You did jump your intro. I was going to say, here's my favorite Slipknot, Jonathan Cohen.
Ba-dum-bum.
Why did I say that?
We have a fantastic guest today.
He is the lead singer of Slipknot.
And if you don't know who Slipknot is,
look up Corey Taylor, and you will find that he's not just the lead singer of a band that has sold, like, I don't know, 30 million records. Like, it's
a lot of records.
Unbelievable. And he's a New York Times bestselling author. He's written, I mean, some really, really wild, and I don't mean wild like crazy. I mean, like, he has written his life, and he has a very specific speaking style, which you'll see, in a very specific thinking style. And he is, I mean, I don't think we've had a guest use more 4- and 5-syllable words completely casually and not pretentiously.
It's interesting that you say that. It did not register to me that he was using language in a way, like, that you're finding so impressive.
He's like a Kaplan course in SAT prep.
We've never had a guest speak about paranormal activity.
I can't even.
And extrasensory experiences In the last third of the interview, we get into some stuff.
I mean.
And if you are only listening to this episode, you are missing Mime's jaw on the floor for 25 minutes. She's terrified. She's crying. Her mouth is open. She's gripping her skin.
Just sounds like every other Wednesday. No, what I think is really important for people to know about this episode is this is a person that we are speaking to who is...
Not woo-woo. Very matter of fact.
I mean, like, kind of reluctant to even get into this because he knows exactly what people think. But I don't think I've ever heard anyone speak about this topic in a way that made me really kind of, like, want to examine it in a real way. Because I've heard stories like this and I'm like, wow, that's intense. That's insane. Like, people have had a lot to say about this house, in particular, the one that we film in.
It creaks a lot.
Okay. Don't make me cry more.
It sounds like people are running on the roof on a regular basis.
That's squirrels and maybe an occasional deer. The thing about Corey Taylor, he comes from a place where this wasn't like talked to. It's not like he grew up in an environment of like, let's all be in tune with our energy. He also doesn't fully understand what it is that this episode is blowing my mind.
Tell us more about Corey.
He's the front man for Slipknot and also Stone Sour. As I said, he's a best-selling author. He's also an actor. I mean, this guy needs his own show. He has a roaring voice. He has millions of fans across the globe. I mean, name the thing, like Billboard this, rock album of the decade this. Unbelievable. He had a book, Seven Deadly Sins, in 2011 that occupied the New York Times bestseller list for 4 weeks. And that was kind of his exploration of his life as a musician and as a troubled young man and teenager. But he's also written A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Heaven, You're Making Me Hate You, and America 51. And one of those books is the one that talks about the paranormal, and we'll be talking about that. He is a Renaissance man who can give a symposium at Oxford University and later that night headline a heavy metal music festival. He's unbelievable. Also want to give a shout out to Slipknot's having a tour. And it's called the Knotfest Roadshow. It starts March 16 in Fargo, North Dakota. He also has a new solo album, CMFB .. So absolutely check that out. That's released February 2022. And that's B-sides of covers. It's acoustic recordings and very, very, I mean, just there's so many exciting things about him. But boy, let's welcome Corey Taylor.
Break it down.
Corey, welcome to our breakdown.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. I have a lot of questions that might have nothing to do with anything else that we're supposed to talk about.
We're not supposed to talk about anything that's particular.
Well, I'm going to already apologize for Jonathan because he's from Toronto. Do they have Slipknot in Toronto?
They have Slipknot everywhere.
Okay, just checking. Yeah. But sometimes they spend all their time with hockey. We don't know.
Well, between the hockey and the poutine, I mean, it's a lot to do, you know?
Well, here's the thing. I fashion myself like a real music person. And, you know, I'm a musician, as it were. And I grew up...
Do you have as many singles as he does?
No. I'm not a real musician like that. But... You know, I grew up with like constant music playing. Like my dad was the kind of guy who had like a different song for every year. Like I could tell you in 1979, the record that he kept playing, you know, like I grew up with like music all around me and like blues, jazz, all the things. You belong to a genre of music that I know very little about. Like I know your music, but in terms of like, as a musician, can I form my head around it? It's just very hard for me. Right. And so it's just really interesting because this not only is a very respectable and significant and important and awesome, genre of music, but there are many, many band members in this kind of band. So, like, I know what happens in an orchestra because I've played in one, right? Like, I know what happens even in a jazz band, because I've played in one. What happens when you have this many people in a band?
We like to call it controlled chaos, basically. I mean, it's because we borrow so many different elements from so many different parts of our genre. Like, we're not a very specific band. And maybe that's because we have so many different people in the band.
Right.
But a lot of it has lent itself esoterically, musically, creatively, spiritually even, to the fact that in our little bubble, we can do so many different things. So with the percussion, we can build a song just based around a percussive beat and kind of build it from the floor up. Or we can start with a riff and kind of build it more traditionally. Or we can use Sid to drop a beat that he scratches and kind of manipulates with all of his weird cosmic craziness that mm-hmm. he does. Or we can base it around a weird hook that Craig, our sampler, comes up with that we then just kind of wrap a tune around, and his hook kind of comes in. I mean, and we've even written songs around melodies that I've come up with. Like, so there's so many different ways for us to write that it started out as an experiment with how can we make this music and be able to play it righteously live. So it wasn't just, okay, well, these guys, they have all of these elements and stuff, but you don't see any of it live. This was our way of honestly creating a sort of destructive metal orchestra. We've kind of been calling ourselves the heavy metal Wu-Tang for a very long time.
That makes sense.
There's so many elements and keys to it that without all of these elements, it doesn't feel like Slipknot. Like, if you took any of these elements away, it would only feel like one layer, you know?
Okay, so in theory, though, are there nine of you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so one person does percussion, backing vocals, samples. Then mm-hmm. another person does samples, media, keyboards, and guitars. Mm-hmm. Then it looks like there's someone who just does guitars. I'm just looking on Wiki.
That's okay. Don't go on Wiki. Oh, Wiki is very, very manipulated.
Okay,
sometimes.
But you know why Wiki's great? It's got this insane chart, and I don't know if you can see. And so I'm trained as a scientist, and this looks like the human genome. It looks
that
like the human genome.
That chart may be broken down on like people who write as well, because certain people, you know, they may play drums in the band, but they also write, so they play guitar or they play, you know, so.
What do you most do?
In Slipknot, I just sing.
You just sing?
Yeah, I've played piano on some songs, but when it's just me, I just sing.
Do you write also?
Yeah, absolutely. But then
so
I give it to them.
And, and then they write.
And they make it better, exactly, yeah.
My MB Alex Breakdown is supported by BetterHelp Online Therapy.
Relationships take work.
They sure do.
Especially the most important one you can have in your life, your relationship with yourself. A lot of us will drop anything to help someone we care about. We'll go out of our way to treat other people well, but we don't often give ourselves the same treatment. One of the ways that I treat myself well is by going to, and you, and everyone who comes in contact with me, is by going to therapy. And this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else. Therapy is a great way to make sure that you show up for yourself. Therapy has been a life changer for me, a game changer, as it were. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. You don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It is more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with someone in under 48 hours. It's that quick. Give it a try. See why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. And Jonathan, what happens to our listeners?
They get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/break. That's BETTERHELP.com/break. My MB Alex Breakdown is supported by Nutrafol.
30 million women are impacted by weakened or thinning hair, and I'm one of them. If you are one of us, you're not alone, and there is a solution that you can trust to deliver results. Thousands of women have taken back control of their hair with Nutrafol. Nutrafol has two formulas targeted for women that are clinically shown to improve hair growth and thickness with less shedding through all stages of life. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after 6 months. Nutrafol is a wonderful way to start taking better care of your hair and restoring your confidence in the process. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com. Enter the promo code BREAK, save $15 off your first month subscription. This is their best offer anywhere. It's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. Plus, you get free shipping on every order. $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code BREAK. Take us back. Let's talk about young Corey.
Oh, boy. All right.
There's a tremendous amount of stigma in certain parts of the world about this, quote, kind of music or this kind of lifestyle. Throughout history, there have been musical genres that have upset people, you know, in terms of like, oh, the lifestyle. I mean, jazz, you know, blues, punk, even new wave, you know, like what was going on there? But I'm interested sort of like how, I'm interested in kind of when we could identify that Corey was going to make this kind of music. So you grew up in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I've spent some time in Mason City.
Oh, 30 minutes from Clear Lake. I used to live there. Yeah, I
Are
know
you
exactly
serious?
Where that is.
Oh, it's beautiful. Anyway,
yeah.
Okay, sorry. So you grew up in Iowa, and just give us a thumbnail sketch. Is your family like, we've lived in Iowa for 8 generations?
Oh, well, some of them have, yeah. There's like 2 factions of my family. There's the family I claim, and then there's the family that I don't really talk to anymore. So growing up was very fractious. We moved around a lot. We were very poor, kind of hand to mouth. Dealt with, I mean, it's a cavalcade of cliches, you know? I mean, it was a lot of addiction, a lot of hardship, a lot of, you know, psychoses. That's not great for a kid, you know? So I kind of trained myself to be a loner, you know? And the only real solace I had was in the art that I engaged in, music, reading, comics, hanging out with my friends, you know, like who were into it, but I didn't have a lot of friends like that because it was Iowa, you know. So,
did you have siblings?
Yeah, a sister. We were close when we were young, and then we just kind of parted because she went one way and I went another. You know,
I mean, it was, and what did your folks do?
I didn't meet my dad until I was 30, and. And you know, we only really hung out for a handful of years. I haven't seen him in a very long time. My mom, well, like I said, man, we lived hand to mouth, you know, it was difficult. It was a difficult childhood. But my grandmother was my rock. She was the center of my world, you know, and she was the one who, I ended up living with after, I had a really bad overdose when I was 16. And I ended up moving in with my grandmother, moved to Des Moines. And that became my kind of station. And she took me in, got me back in high school and stuff for a short period of time. And she was always kind of like my stability, you know? And so she was like the one who kind of raised me.
Obviously, you're not only, you know, a musician and a very successful musician at that. You're a writer and you have, you're a best-selling author and you've written a lot about some of the kind of, I guess, most intimate and, you know, challenging parts of your life. You know, somewhere between the kind of, you know, difficulty, how did we get to an overdose at 16? So if you can just talk us through a little bit, like, did you start playing music and that was a thing? Yeah, I mean, I would love to know if you're, you know, open to sharing.
First time I got drunk, I was 10. It was right around the time I started smoking cigarettes too. First time I got high, I was 12. First time I did cocaine was, well, back up. The first time I did speed, I was 13. And I got into these things called White Cross. For all the old people, they remember White Crosses and stuff like that. But and then me and my friends started stealing anything from TVs to cars to buy cocaine. We just, I mean, and it was just a downhill spiral from there.
That's a very expensive drug for those of you listening.
It is, especially in Iowa at the time, man. Like, it was very hard to get. Sometimes you would have to deal with just crank, which is, you know, mm-hmm. basically, you know, it kind of in the meth family, but it was a little more cantankerous, really. But we went out of our way to try and find cocaine when we could. Mm-hmm. But, and largely it was so cut down that sometimes it would just, I mean, everything that was in it was more dangerous than the cocaine itself, you know?
Right.
So it was, you know, it was just, that was all I knew, you know? I mean, I was living in Waterloo, Iowa, which to this day is still a very mm-hmm. hardcore city, you know? Mm-hmm. It's brutal. We used to call it Little Detroit because it was so gnarly, especially back then. And that was just what we did, you know. I went to a party one night, blacked out on drugs. I don't remember anything except waking up. I woke up in a dumpster, and I was covered in blood. And I think what happened was I OD'd, and the people at the party didn't know what to do, so they just threw me away. Yeah, that was kind of a wake-up call for me, man. And it was just like, all right, well, I guess we're done here. So I let go of drugs, but I continued drinking, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess I was the precursor to the California sober, you know, that's what you do.
Well, I was going to say, it's one of the things that, you know, we do when trying to get sober. We try and, like, find what's the least
right.
I can do to still stay numb but not
exactly.
have it be as dangerous or ruining my life as much.
But what happens for you that morning and like that maybe 3 days after you wake up in that state, realizing that maybe the friendships that you thought you had weren't quite so tight as you might have thought.
I never spoke to those people again, you
wow.
know, like I ended up walking quite a long, it took me a couple hours to get home. I was a long way from my house and I got there and I can remember going, I need to get out of this town because this town is really what's doing it. You know, like it was not only the town, but it was the people I was running with. It was
the lifestyle
that
yep.
I accepted, you know, and I knew that I had more to offer than what was happening. And I knew it wasn't going to happen there. So I packed up what little I had and I went to my grandmother's for the summer. And while I was there, I really kind of hyper-focused on the fact that I need to stay here. So I talked my grandmother into letting me stay. I had to talk my mom into signing over parental rights so I could go to school. And then that was it. So, I mean, the first couple days was just this weird cold bath of guilt and incredulous reality. You know, especially for a kid.
You know? You're still a kid.
Even to that point, I had been through a lot, but I had never almost died. You know, like I had experienced abuse. I had experienced like all of these gnarly things that kind of come with that culture. But this was like the first time I was like, oh, okay, so this could happen. You know, so for a few days, it was just me kind of collecting myself. And I mean, I went through some serious withdrawal, you know, but I stuck it out just so I didn't have to give it to somebody else. I needed to feel the weight of it and be able to accept that I needed to do this on my own.
I'm curious, when you go through the effort that it takes to change your life, you know, getting to your grandmother's, convincing your mom to let you stay there, I assume you start to roll in school.
Yeah.
How long does that sort of like, you know, because you've made this huge change. So there's like an excitement, a rush of like, oh, you've pulled it off.
Right.
But how long does it take before sort of, you know, the notion of wherever you go, there you are, and you find
right.
your problems again?
The drinking didn't get bad until well into my 20s, to be honest, because it was almost like I had this new lease on life. And I really tried to kind of expound on it. In Des Moines, I was not only with my grandmother, but I was surrounded by cousins who were the same age, who I'd grown up with and really enjoyed spending time with, you know? So I ran with them for a while. I ended up making new friends in Des Moines. And they were so far from removed from it. And I did that on purpose. I didn't want anybody who was in that sort of like new circle, you know, the same as the old boss kind of thing, you know? So it didn't, once I'm weird in a weird way where once I make a decision, that's it. And I just have to hyper-focus on that, and it keeps me going. It was the same thing when I quit drinking. It was the same when I quit smoking.
This is a lot. Like, I mean, I have a 16-year-old. So, like, you know, he still, like, is asking me to, like, help him register for his community college classes. And I'm thinking of, like, the kind of things...
An awareness that he had.
Well, the kind of awareness, well, and that usually comes from, you know, that's the school of hard knocks. Like, this is this is what, you know, my parents called street smart. I don't care if you're book smart. You got to be street smart, you know?
Right.
And that usually comes from, it's pain. Anyway, so.
How do we give Miles more pain?
How do I give my child more pain so that he's more resilient? No, I'm just kidding. There's something about your brain and the things that you were interested in. That, like, you are known for using very big words. You've already used several words. So
yeah, I would apologize. Like
to, no, do not apologize.
I can't help it.
No, I know. You're just, that's your awesomeness. But what I'd like to know is, because not that that's necessarily the way that your path becomes different, but, I mean, thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of people deal with addiction, deal with the kind of trauma and abuse that many of us never even knew to speak about. And you and I are about the same age. And many do not have, I mean, many OD and wake up in all sorts of places, right? So I'm wondering, it seems like there might have been kind of like a different place in your brain or your soul that you had somehow kept sacred that seems to have maybe been part of this ability that you had to see more than many kids would see at 16. So what was that place? What was it? Books? Was it literature? Was it?
Even before I realized I was gifted at music, I always felt different, not only from the people that I ran with, but the people I lived with, you know? I mean, maybe it was the search that was still going on that kind of kept me focused and away from that once I got out of it. Going, remember, there's bigger fish to fry here, and you need to focus on that. So kind of whittling everything away. At one point, I wanted to just be a writer, you know, but I realized that wasn't going to quench that thirst. It wasn't until I really played my first real show, which was a basement party, when I was 17, 18, somewhere in there. It was like this, I was with this cover band at the time that I knew I wasn't going to be happy just playing covers, but I knew there was something about what I was doing that made me happy. And that's when I kind of started teaching myself how to play guitar just so I could write songs. So maybe that was what it was. Like, I knew that there was something that I was destined for. You know?
Let's play this game because, you know, I'm an actor person, you know, also.
Right.
And, you know, in the words of John Popper, great blues traveler. He says, if you want to hide, find a stage. And I'm wondering if there was something about the special. I don't know why I'm making myself cry talking about this person. But like the specialness that you always felt in yourself.
Right.
That being differentness. When you find a stage. You then have a place to mine that feeling.
Yeah, I want to hear about the basement party, that moment that you sort of discover that.
Yeah, it was, you know, honestly, it was a throwback to a moment that I had when I was 10 years old. And my cousin Lisa forced me out into the living room of my Aunt Susan's house and made me sing Separate Ways by Journey. It had just come out on vinyl and I was singing along to it. And she said, is that you? And I was like, yeah. And she drugged me out in front of my grandma and everybody. And she made me sing. And at the end of the song, they all were like clapping and like yelling. And it was the first time I had that feeling that I was good at something. So fast forward to I'm down with these people and they're like, well, what songs do you know? And I was like, well, I know everything. I mean, name a genre, I know everything. And so they just started throwing out We started with the Ramones, went into Twisted Sister. I mean, and so, I mean, I'm just hitting all these beats, and more people are starting to push into the basement. And I just remember going, oh yeah. Like, and it wasn't just that I was good at it. There was this amazing sense of fulfillment that came out of it as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why my voice is so chameleonic, is because I cut my teeth singing along to so many different genres that it just made it really adaptable to almost anything that I write or attempt, you know?
Jonathan, which neurotransmitters did he just describe?
I have no idea.
Yes, you do. What did he say? It felt good, and yeah, it's this though. That's dopamine.
Dopamine? Yeah.
That's
oh
it.
Yeah.
I mean,
mighty
that's a
dopamine.
That's a fix, right? I mean, you're getting a fix, because it's not just that it feels good. It's what can I do to keep this going?
Well, I'm fascinated by these moments, which is like these transformational moments, and it's fascinating that sort of connected back to obviously a big dopamine hit that you got when you were 10. But just, I'm curious about the prep. Like, where did you get your musical education? Was it like radio that you're consuming?
All by ear.
And by education, I mean more exposure. Like, where are you consuming that amount of music?
Oh, kind of everywhere. I mean, I was kind of exposed to so many different types of music. My mom made me listen to everything from Motown to disco. My babysitters all listened to 70s punk. I was a latchkey kid, so I grew up on early 80s MTV.
Yeah, you
so
did.
So I'm getting all that. I'm getting all of the great new wave pop, but I'm also getting Motley Crue. I'm getting Quiet Riot. I'm getting Def Leppard. So my uncle Jim was a fan of Itzhak Perlman. So I grew up, yeah. So I'm getting everything from everywhere. And I knew every year that if I wanted to make my Uncle Jim happy, all I had to do was get him an Itzhak Perlman cassette. And he was like, well, thank you. So, I mean, so I grew up surrounded by so many different, I mean, my great uncles were into jazz. So I'm getting, you know, Sonny Rollins, like all of these people. So I'm surrounded, and I'm getting all of this stuff. And then obviously it's Iowa, so I've got like 50s and 60s country just blaring in my head.
It sounds like you have a brain that just, when you hear it, it's in there now. And like a brain for lyrics. And Mayim has this too, where I'll throw Spotify on and she's like, every lyric of every song.
Right.
And I know the chorus of every song, but I don't know every lyric. But it sounds like you have one of those brains that you could get on stage and, you know, you've just consumed and almost internalized all of that music.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is, but I know there are other people who have it, where you listen to it and there's only specific people listen to music in a certain way where you can really, like, you're breaking it down. You're not only analyzing the lyrics, but you're listening to all of the layers of the music that is going on. So you're not only hearing the hook in the vocals, but you're hearing the hook in just the little ear candy that the drummer's putting on, or the little hint of synth in the background. And when somebody plays it live and it's not there, you go, and it's...
Yep, that's me.
It's like a photographic... for music.
I mean, it also, it feels wrong if it's not.
Right. Yeah. It's almost sonographic memory.
My Bialik Breakdown is supported by Squarespace.
Squarespace is the all-in-one platform to build a beautiful online presence and run your business. You've used Squarespace.
You know what I used to build my first website?
What?
Squarespace.
That's what I just said. Squarespace is everything to sell anything. They have the tools you need to get your business off the ground, e-commerce templates, inventory management, a simple checkout process, and secure payments. Whatever you sell, Squarespace has merchandising features to make your products look their best online. Connect with your audience and generate revenue through gated members-only content, manage your members, send email communications, and leverage audience insights all on one easy-to-use platform. Gain powerful insights into who's visiting your site and how they're interacting with your content with the analytics tool, including page views, traffic sources, time on site, most read content, audience geography, and more.
Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/breakdown and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. My MB Alex Breakdown is supported by Ritual.
Oh, Jonathan, if I've told you once, I've told you 97 times.
Gaps, don't leave my clothes on the floor.
No, gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. And over 97% of women aged 19 to 50, they're not getting enough vitamin D from their diet. 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Enter Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus Multivitamin. It was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women 18 and over. It's formulated to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, antioxidant support. But did Ritual stop there?
Probably not.
They did not. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of this multivitamin, which was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. What's a reason to take a multivitamin every day?
To feel better.
To feel better, to fill all those gaps in your diet. We love Ritual because it is one way to get everything you need in one happy little multivitamin. And then, you know, you're starting the day off right. Right now, Ritual is offering our listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/breakdown. Turn healthy habits into a ritual.
That's 10% off at ritual.com/breakdown.
Well, and it's funny because this kind of leads to my next question, because whenever people say to me like, oh, you're smart, it's actually more that I remember things.
Right.
Because a
recall.
Lot of like when, and also when I went to like, you know, when I went to college, like the kids who made it to med school, I couldn't. It's that they had a brain that held information in a way that I couldn't. And I thought I had a good brain for that. But
right.
What I do musically is also what I do with words when I read them in books. Or like, I remember my SAT flashcards. I just know those words. So that's what I was kind of like, I think we're tapping into more of like Corey's brain, as opposed to like Corey's a musician. And he's also really like, this is your brain is very special. So what were you reading? What were you exposed to? Like, where'd you get all your big words?
I mean, I grew up, I started reading very early. Like, mm-hmm. I was voracious by the time I was about 6 or 7. I was reading novels. So I remember I read Benchley's Jaws when I was 8. It scared the hell out of me.
That's like, terrifying.
To this day, it's probably one of the biggest reasons why I'm scared of sharks like nobody's business. And I had the original paperback, which was even scarier than the movie poster, because it's that that dark background and it's really just this highlighted outline and this person saying, and it's just this shape, which is even scarier. And you're just like, ah! But I would spend so much time at libraries, you know? Because, I mean, obviously, we couldn't afford to buy books or anything. And the books we did have, we held on to, you know? I mean,
yeah.
My mom had stacks of Harlequin super romances that I didn't go near. I was just like, that's too frilly. But we would go to the library, and I would just check stuff. I'd come home with stacks of books and read all those. I would get books at school, read all those. I collect books now. I mean, I have so many books coming out of so many orifices. It's not even funny.
Were you good at school? Or did you have kind of specific interest?
It's interesting. I retained a lot, but I was, and maybe this is my confrontational side, I absolutely despised homework. Hmm. I didn't understand it. I was like, wait a minute, let me get this straight.
No point.
I know all the answers. I'm the one who answers all the questions in class. I ace every test. And yet you're going to fail me because I didn't do 80% of the grade, which is all take-home stuff. I was like, are you kidding me? It's like, I don't even know where I'm going to be living at the next time I come back to this school, and you're going to sweat me on a notebook. Like, so that made me very kind of anti-authoritarian. I threw a desk at my English teacher.
She probably deserved it.
Mr. Burns, he was very sanctimonious and really condescending. To the point of, you know, he made this passing remark about my hair because I had long hair. And I just stood up and tossed it. And I didn't even wait for him to send me. I just walked right out the door. I was like, I'll be in Mr. Johnson's rep, you know.
once you moved to Des Moines, did you finish high school there then?
No, I was asked to leave.
Okay, makes sense.
Because I started a riot in the lunchroom.
Like you do. Largely
based on what they were using in the foodstuffs, you know? I remember they would give us this very specific sort of pale white macaroni and cheese that I was convinced they were cutting with spackle. And I took it and I stuck it on the wall and it stayed. And I jumped up on a table and I said, "Do you see what they are putting in our bodies? Are you going to let them pollute?" Like, it was just this whole, I was kind of looking for a door, you know, like I just needed an excuse. But the next day I went and got my GED, graduated class of Thursday, 1992. It was cool, you know?
I mean, I'm going to ask a dumb question. So then what?
I immersed myself in the music scene in Des Moines. I started working. This was right before my 19th birthday. I'd missed a year. I should have been a junior, but I was still a sophomore. And so I'd missed a year of school because of my life in Waterloo. So I was already behind. I was already older than everybody that was there. I didn't want to go to an alternative because I just knew it was going to give me reasons to not go, you know? So I went and got my GED. I started working and I just started working on the idea for my first real band, which became Stone Sour, which I started in 1992. And we lasted 5 years until I joined Slipknot.
And what was your kind of recreational life like at this time? Were you still, let's say, drinking but not doing other drugs?
Yeah. No, I wasn't doing any drugs, but, you know, obviously you're part of the nightlife. And, you know, when you're out hanging and stuff, I'm a binge drinker. And, you know, depending on the money I have in my pocket, you know, it can be a boozy night or it can be a chill night, you know? So, you know, I would have massive drunks, but then I would also have drunks that were just hanging out.
So I'm going to ask another dumb question, but I think it's important. And I also just really appreciate you, like, you know, letting us kind of poke at you this way. But obviously, you know, drinking serves its own purpose and also is much more kind of, you know, socially acceptable, I would say. Mm-hmm. What was fulfilled in you that sort of was able to let you exist, let's say, without the drug portion of your life and sort of, because obviously you're still filling that like God-shaped hole, you know, whatever.
Right.
Yeah. What was it like not doing all the drugs that you had done for quite some time, which of course is like, I mean, I don't want to say enjoyable because I don't want to glamorize it, but it's a lifestyle, but also it does something and lets you have experiences that you then are kind of not having. So I guess, what filled that?
I mean, I don't really know. I mean, the cocaine just allowed me to stay out. And when I was drinking on cocaine, obviously you don't really feel it, you know? It's just kind of a, you know, it's that God button in your head. You're just like, I'm invincible. And you just kind of go. When I quit, I realized that I was really naturally super hyper. So, I mean, you think I'm bouncy now? You should have seen me 25 years ago. I was, they called me Super Ball for a while because I would just, I mean, just, I would bounce off the walls. It was almost obnoxious. And I don't know if it was because of the effects that the drugs had on my my endorphins or whatever. Like, you know, they just kind of pulse. Yeah. But the booze slowed me down.
Got it.
My brain was, even though I was kind of hyper-focused and stuff, I was still very chaotic. And that could have been because of age or whatever, but it was hard for me to focus. It was hard for me to settle down, you know? So drinking 9 times out of 10 relaxed me. It's like my brain was always like this closed fist. Yeah. And it would just kind of let that go.
So when did you get clean or sober or any of those words?
I quit drinking the first time December 2003. And I was sober for about 3 years.
Wow. How did you get sober?
I just quit. I had reasons to to get it together, I had really gone off a deep end, like as far as like drinking was going. Like it kind of all, it had caught up with me to the point where I had at least two bottles of Jack Daniels with me at all times. Mm. I would drink all the way up until I left the house. The only reason I left the house was to go to the bar. I would order four Jack and Cokes at last call, just so I could drink as I'm getting into whatever car I decided to get into, and wake up, rinse, repeat. And it was mm-hmm. gross. You know, my health was bad. I was about 50 pounds overweight. My life was chaos, and I was losing my ability to do what I do. My singing was really getting bad, and it was, yeah, I mean, life just wasn't enjoyable.
So that was three years of that. And right. what were those 3 years like, generally speaking?
It was tough. When you eliminate everything that can distract you, you start to see things so clearly. And it made me realize there was a lot of things in my life that were lending itself to a lot of the reasons why I was unhappy. You know, I was a joyless marriage. We married young, but we weren't good for each other. We had a son together, my son Griffin, and it didn't work. You know, so that didn't last long. We got married after I got sober. Mm-hmm. That lasted almost 2 years, but then it kind of fell apart. It was the first time I really kind of took stock of who I was in that moment. And it's like, okay. And this is after Slipknot. This is after Slipknot. This right. is after Stone Sour getting back together. So now I'm at this whole other place in my life that I have to kind of come to grips with, you know. It's like, I have a career, I have family, I have, you know, responsibilities, but I also have this ache that needs to be figured out by me, not by other stuff, you know?
This is, you know, one of my favorite expressions. If you want to find out why you're using, stop using.
Oh, yeah. Drinking, that's great. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Drinking is not it's not the thing that's wrong. It's the thing right. that we try and do because everything else feels wrong.
Right.
And that's kind of that, you know, well, sobering is obviously the word. So, yeah, super dying to know. What happened after those 3 years?
Well, I got divorced, started living on my own again. And there's that weird moment where you convince yourself, it's like, oh, well, it was because of all those problems. Right? I mean, it can't be me.
I can drink like other people.
Exactly.
I can drink like other people.
I can't even say I fell off the wagon, because I just kind of started socially drinking, and it kind of slow. And honestly, it never got bad again.
Yeah.
I stopped drinking largely because I had lost my bass player. Paul died that year. That kind of refocuses you, is that, you know, your mortality is back in the picture. And it was a shocking blow. And after that, even though I was still drinking for a minute, I just remember going, I'm not getting anything out of this. You know, like, I miss my man. My hangovers are lasting 3 days. I'm like, I mean, how old am I?
Welcome to drinking past like 28.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was, God, at the time I was 38.
Mm-hmm. Oh, as you get towards 40, forget it.
Dude. Oh, I just the thought of drinking today.
Yep.
No. Oh my God.
I was thinking about this, and I mean, there have been times in my life when I've definitely drank more than I should. That's not my allergy. Although I do have an allergy to alcohol, which I acquired. I blame you. But one of the things that I remember that completely went away, besides the calories that I wasn't just consuming for no reason.
Right.
What started happening, even if I'd just have like a couple drinks, I would wake up hourly. And I was like, this is not worth it. But I have to wake up to pee every hour. That's not normal. I don't want that life. Anyway, and yes, a hangover, which you'd get from, you can get from two drinks as a grown, like if you're over 40, one mojito will give you a hangover. For 2 days, I'd have like a migraine. I'm like, this is not worth it. It's not worth
it. Well, that's largely the gin. You know, gin was just like, tastes like a Christmas tree.
It wasn't
anyway.
The cucumber and the mint, I'll tell you that much.
Could have been that, yeah. I really wish I had a better last day of drinking story. It's so sad. I drank two Becks and I didn't even get drunk. I never drank beer anyway. And I just kind of did it out of boredom. And I was kind of on the fence where I was going to stop drinking anyway. And I remember waking up the next day and I thought I had the flu. And I was just like, oh, what the hell? And it lasted so long. I was just like, there's no way it was these two Becks that I drank. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done. I just, you know what? Keep my tools. I'm never coming back to this job. This is stupid, you know? And that was it.
Have you ever worked a program, or you're just a person who just does it?
No, I was in NA when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I went to Alateen meetings and stuff. But I think it was the day I showed up wasted that they asked me never to come back. You know, there's always that moment where nobody knows. That's got everybody snowed. And you could wake up and you're like, come on. It's so bad. I have nothing against the program. It's just for me, I just know when it's done, mm-hmm. you know? And once it's done, that's it, you know? And I couldn't say that about the first time that I quit, but I could say it about that last time. I was just like, you know what? It's not for me anymore.
And what other support have you, I mean, obviously your social group and, you know, being part of, I'm making this up, but I have a feeling that like this kind of music also, and this kind of like creating together, and also the kind of energy that comes from this sort of organized chaos.
Right.
There's a real kind of community building, I think, you know, that must happen. So that's like it sounds like a very good and significant support system. But did you ever go to therapy? Did you ever see a counselor?
Like, yeah, I've done therapy. I've done therapy a lot actually over the years. Just to kind of sort out not only my various thought processes, but, you know, it's just to kind of make peace with some of the stuff that I went through when I was younger. Mm-hmm. Those things creep up, whether you like it or not, you know, especially when you have kids and, you know, and you're trying to avert the mistakes that, you know, maybe you grew up with, the way it was handled, you know, trying to sometimes doing the same thing that you were used to, and I've never hit my kids or anything, but I've definitely raised my voice. And I realized that can cause so much anxiety that it's not good. But I didn't learn that until my wife, who is amazing. She read a couple of these books that really showed the effects that can have.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about it, with my therapist and realizing that, you know, it's not just me displacing the anxiety I'm feeling because I can't control a situation. It's because that ramps up and it feeds their anxiety, and it's just, nobody wins in that situation. So finding healthier ways to parent has actually kind of rededicated myself to finding a better way to be a better person, you know?
How old is Griffin now?
Griffin is 19.
Wow.
Yeah. He's going to be 20 this year. And it's my heart just, you know, and he's in a band that's doing really well right now. They're going. Yeah, I know, man. As much as I tried to just let him, you know, free range and, you know, just be his own self. At one point when he was younger, he wanted to be a botanist and a video game tester. And I was like, hey, I mean, go. Hey, run with the bulls. Make it happen.
Yeah.
And then he just gravitated right to the stuff, you know, and I couldn't stop him.
You married again?
I did, yeah. This is actually my third marriage. My last marriage, which was not the yes. Griffin's mother.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's actually my daughter's mother.
Got it.
That lasted about 8 years, and I mean, I won't go into specifics, but it wasn't a good time.
How old's your daughter?
My daughter's 7.
Wow.
So yeah. So I have. Let's do the list. I have a high school daughter who is 29. I have Griffin, who's 19, and I have Ryan, my daughter, who's 7. So I have to be careful every 10 years. Apparently, I'm very fertile. You know, it's very weird.
Do you like to talk about the 29-year-old? That's an old child. That's a
grown-up.
Yeah,
Angie. You know, it's weird because her mother and I split up when we were very young, you know? Mm-hmm. And she went her way. I went my way. And it wasn't until the first time I got sober that I really was able to be in her life, you know? Wow. So I didn't come into her life until she was about 11.
Wow.
And even though we have so much in common and we look exactly the same, which poor, you know, I keep apologizing to her. I'm so sorry. I was her father, but I wasn't her dad, you know? And I had all the respect in the world for her stepfather. And, you know, you try to develop the best relationship you can, you know? And, you know, it's been up and down over the years. Right now it's down. But at the same time, you know, you can't, you know, you have that love and that love is always going to be there.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious when you stopped smoking cigarettes and why.
I quit, oh God, coming up on 7 years ago, maybe even longer. I quit because it was just time. My ex-wife and their family, they were talking about quitting. And I've been smoking almost 2 packs of cigarettes a day since I was 10 years old.
Wow.
And I mean, it is bad, you know. We would steal cigarettes just at 10, you know. We were like a little Dickens novel, for God's sakes. But, you know, I kind of reached the end of my run with them. And I tried to quit. It was the one thing that I could never quit.
So I had a feeling you were going to say this. Cigarettes is, I mean, it's a very, 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 very difficult addiction. Yeah.
I was able to do it with Chantix, and I'm not going to turn it into a Chantix commercial, but I think, I don't know if it was because you could continue to smoke on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was, but it made every cigarette taste like garbage.
Wow. And
whereas before, every cigarette tasted like it was kissed by Jesus. I mean, it was so good. And I know I smelled like death, but I didn't care, you know? Mm-hmm. I quit. It was right before my spinal surgery. And luckily, I had already been off cigarettes for a while because they were going to make me quit anyway. And I was like, your luck. You caught me at the right time in my life. Because I don't have to do that anymore. And
what was your spinal surgery for?
I had a collapsed, two collapsed discs, my C5 and 6.
Oh,
were
ouch.
Completely crushed. We think it was from an injury where I fell off stage in 99 and I landed on my head. And it kind of hyper-compressed them. And then over the years, but then I didn't go get it checked out.
Yeah, I was going to
say. So over the years, doing the crazy headbanging stuff. Yeah. I mean, and I could show you footage and you'd be like, how does a neck even do that? Like, it's so stupid. But that's just what we do. The doctor told me that it was like it was the worst injury he'd ever seen. He's like, I've seen MMA fighters with injuries that don't even come close to that. I had no strength on my right side.
Yeah.
I was completely off balance. I was borderline incontinent, which is so much fun.
And now, after the surgery?
Now, I had a surgery. They jacked it up. They replaced the disc because the disc was completely gone. I don't know what it is. It was this fibrous material that basically adheses to or whatever. But they had to shave the bone out of my spinal cord.
Yeah.
Because it was like growing into it.
Yeah. It's like
it was gnarly. I still have a gnarly bruise on it that you can see in x-rays.
Wow.
How has that impacted your performance? And how is basic, you know, it's a young man's game to be that energetic.
You're not wrong. Luckily, I still think I'm 28. it affected me for the for the first year. It was tough, man. I had to wear a neck brace on stage to remind myself not to do all that crazy stuff. I gained a lot of weight because I wasn't able, because I was very athletic up until that point. I would work out all the time. And it's been hard to kind of find the balance with that, especially at my age. You know, once you hit a certain age, man, that metabolism, it's damn near finite. So it triggered a lot of depression for me. But you know, at the same time, it was, you know, the further I got away from it, I did a lot of PT for it and everything. And I was able to get the strength back in my right side. My balance is back. I didn't lose my voice, which was rad, because I had to pull everything to the side because they went through here.
Got it.
Yeah. It's good. I'm fine now.
That's an intense surgery. You have many books, as our research has told us. And what's interesting to me, more than the books themselves, that each one has a title, and then it also has an or, and in brackets, it has another title.
That was not my choice. That was, yeah. I hate it. Yeah.
Well, this might not be great then, because I'm going to dive into one of the or titles.
Oh, I can't wait.
That's my favorite one, too.
And the title of the book is A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Heaven.
Okay, go ahead.
Or How I Made Peace with the Paranormal and Stigmatized Zealots and Cynics in the Process. And I'm very curious about how I made peace with the paranormal and what that entails for you.
Well, the whole book is about my experiences with what I call intelligent energy. A lot of other people would call them ghosts or spirits or whatever, which, you know, I mean, it definitely applies. But I was always hesitant to talk about that stuff because it almost always came back to religion. And I've never been a religious person. I've always been much more of a pragmatic, practical, more scientific, I guess, to put it a better way. So I always struggled with that. It was just like, I have all these things that happen to me, I've seen, that I've experienced, that I've been able to share with other people, but I don't know how to wrap my head around it. Like, what is it, you know? So the book was really my way of finding a thought process that made sense of all of it. And then that was it. So,
I mean, Corey, you've just hit like our sweet spot here. So like, we need you to be really, really specific right now. Like, there's pretty much nothing you can say that we're going to be like, that's crazy. Like, we're out there.
Right.
So be really specific right now.
Let's start with the experience of the paranormal and start talking a little bit about
be specific.
Before you had to make sense of it, you had to experience it.
Right.
So, yeah. And we are not teasing.
No.
We are not. Right. Like, this is literally like you're in a very safe place. And I also think it's really important.
Trust me. I've been in hostile places and it doesn't bother me.
No. But I'm just saying like our interest is like a lot of what we do here is trying to introduce like where is the science to a lot of things that people dismiss? Like, what is our cognitive and conscious experience? Like, there are things we cannot explain. There are things that we cannot quantify. I believe that as a scientist, and we both are very spiritual people. So we're not asking because we want to be like, oh, he believes this. Like, we're legitimately interested in an intelligent, articulate person
having experience with intelligent energy.
Because when we say people are like, they're nuts, but this guy.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example based on one part of my life, which happened to give you a little background, like stuff like this has happened throughout my life since I was younger. I now think a lot of it has to do with the energy that I give off, because everybody has different energy that they give off. Everybody's energy feeds off of one another. And it can feed different fields of energy from different planes, if that makes any sense. Like, it's certain bundles of energy are attracted to other bundles of energy. So they tend to circumnavigate them sometimes, which is what people would call being haunted. So when I was the first house I ever bought.
I'm going to cry. He just made me nervous. Sorry.
Oh, you're fine. No, it's okay.
I think it ghosts.
You need to take a minute.
I won't make it. I promise I won't make it too creepy. All right.
It's okay.
The first house I bought was a Georgian colonial that was built in 1905, and we moved in, and you know I was used to things happening every once in a while at other people's places and stuff, but this was different. Like, a lot of, you know, things, once we got moved in, especially when we had the kids there, and by the kids, I mean, Griffin was born in that house, and my ex-wife's daughter, who would have been my stepdaughter at the time, lived there as well, like between visits and whatnot. So it started slow, things being moved around and whatnot, which, you know, is... You can chalk that up and you can do whatever, you know? And then it got to the point where things were being thrown at us. Like, for real, things being thrown.
And just, hold on. You mean like objects moving through space?
Yes.
So you're just sitting
physical
there.
Physical objects.
Any time of day? Doesn't matter time of day?
It wasn't really a certain time of day. It was just when certain people were around. Like, it was... Because there's a lot of to-do about whether there's a witching hour or anything, or whether or not there's a certain hour when this stuff happens. I've seen things that would apply to that, but from my standpoint, it didn't really matter. It was usually when people are around and these bundles of energy either wanted to show off or they wanted to communicate in a weird way. So what can they do? They move things or they throw things to get attention. It was never malevolent. Like, it was never gnarly. It was intimidating, but it was never anything until we discovered this one entity. We called him the Shadow Man.
I'm never gonna sleep again.
You're not gonna want to hear this. So my son Griffin, he was about three at the time. And whenever I would come home from tour, he would beg me, just like, please, please, please sleep in the room with me, sleep in the room with me. And one night I was like, son, I can't, you know, you're getting to be a big boy. You got to sleep by yourself. Why do you want me to sleep in here? And he said, because when you're in here, the Shadow Man doesn't keep me awake.
Oh my God.
Hold on. The Shadow Man doesn't what?
Doesn't keep me awake. So... That, I was like, oh, Christ. So I knew all the stuff that was going on in the house. There was weird things that were going on in the third floor. There was a third floor attic that was basically another bedroom that guests would stay in for about 3 hours. And then they would come running out. They were like, nope, uh-uh, we're not going to do this. Like, people would have welts on their legs from being, yeah. I mean, it was gnarly.
How long did you live in this haunted house?
Up until I got divorced. And then we sold it and we split it. But some of those entities attached themselves to me. Not the dark one. But there were two younger entities that basically followed me, I think, because I was a father. And they were attracted to that energy that
How do you know they were younger? Describe it. Like, what does that mean to you? How do you know?
I saw them. I saw them. They would run in my old house. They would run across the top floor at a split level. So you would be walking in the door, and up the stairs, you would see the second floor, right? And you could see about this much of the second floor because the ceiling cut it off. And you would see their shoes run across.
I don't like that.
They would stack Griffin's books in the middle of his bedroom. And then when you would put them away again, you would come back and they'd have stacked it again.
Do you know anything else about them?
No, we never tried to communicate with them. You know, I mean, to me, I didn't want to know who they were.
Right.
I just wanted to be able to live with them. You know, like, it wasn't anything where I was trying to get answers or dispel them, because I didn't get gnarly vibes from them. So I wasn't worried about them hurting anybody because it was all childlike stuff. Like they would, I would be making Griffin's breakfast and lunch in the morning before I would take him to school, and they would take his thermos and throw it across the kitchen and it would hit the aluminum sink and it would, and it would just, you know, I haven't had any coffee yet. So I'm just like, it would scare the ever living out of me.
How did the Shadow Man keep him up? Did he ever explain that to you?
So the Shadow Man would stand in the corner and he would stare. And then he would come towards you. I saw this happen. So that night, I slept in bed with him. And I woke up and he had like this nightlight-ish thing. It wasn't a nightlight, but it cast enough of a glow that it kind of illuminated the room. And we're talking about call it a 6x6. It was a little room, you know? And I woke up and I'm fully awake. This wasn't something where it was kind of in between,
you know,
REM state and whatever. I was awake and I looked up and I saw him. There he was. And I closed my eyes again and I opened them again and he was still there. He came towards me. He stood there. And then he vanished and he just evaporated. He just
what'd he look
faded.
Like? What'd
yeah,
he look
in
like?
That state.
Wait, I need to know what he looked
solid?
Like.
Is he translucent?
Yeah, what'd he look like?
Hologram like?
It was this weird mixture. Like it was solid, but you could see through him on the edges.
What is he wearing?
Like what was he wearing? What time period is he from?
It was just kind of dark clothing. Like it was almost like
a
suit.
A cloak. Oh.
It was a very, yeah. I mean, it was, if I had to put a year on it, it would have been something I would have seen 1910s, 1920s, somewhere in there. Like a very rustic, almost like, I don't want to say a preacher's suit, like a country preacher's suit, but something like that, you know? But like I said, it was very faint. Like it was one of those things where you could see the details and I could see his eyes. But his mouth was just this thin line, you know, like it was just very thin. And yeah.
Did your wife at the time, like what was her experience of this?
She had to deal with it while I was on the road.
And did she see them as well? Or was she like, because look, it takes a little bit of having an experience like that. You're talking about it now as though like, oh yeah, that's just what happened. But when you're first experiencing that, and if you're not open to that as a possibility, and
right.
or if two people in a relationship don't have that same understanding,
you would have to hospitalize me. I mean, like right. I would literally be like, I could not.
Well, you don't like anything that's not predictable.
I'm crying just hearing it. I can't. So did these entities stay with you then?
They did for a while. They did right up until, I want to say until about 6 years ago. I feel like they started to kind of dissipate, or they attached themselves to somebody else because I stopped spending as much time in Iowa. I was spending more time in
Las
Vegas.
Maybe Iowa's haunted. The whole freaking state.
Could be. I mean, it's gnarly enough, you know? I think it's because I wasn't there, the natural attraction that energy had started to kind of fade, you know?
So here's an interesting question. Do you have other instances besides this of having a notion of kind of your energy? Meaning, are there other, you know, I'm very curious, like, has anyone ever done like a past life regression on you? Like,
but my wife, my Alicia keeps trying to ask me to do that to see like if there's something that runs.
I'm going to say something super out there, but maybe you're totally comfortable with this. When I talked, maybe I shouldn't say this in front of him because it might freak him out. When I talk to somebody like this, right? And he has this like, you have this kind of like out of place, out of time, you know, meaning like you've always kind of like stood out and you're just like really different. And like, you know, like you carved all these paths that were like very different. And then when I hear things like this, if you were to tell me that this person, if we were able to access that his energy existed in another time, I would completely buy that. I'd be like, this is a person who in this iteration I mean, that's in this iteration, this is the expression of whatever soul this is. We call him Corey, and right. he's in this band, and he does all these things. But there's something about this. He's a special person.
The essence of him has existed in different sort of.
There's something very.
Almost like an energy adherence.
Well, and I'm thinking, like, I always say, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, who's this guy, right? He's got some. I say this about you. Whatever, if this iteration is not the only one, in some past life, there's something, I mean, you're special in your own way, but, like, you have very special skills that I feel have existed. If you existed in other realms, they were, and I feel that way about this guy.
Corey, when was the first time that you began to experience what we'll call paranormal, but really is maybe just extrasensory observations?
I was 10, actually. My friends and I, we went to this abandoned house that was not too far from the apartments that I grew up in Des Moines.
That's when you started drinking. He started drinking at 10.
I did, yeah, but it wasn't around there. This might have caused the drinking. It was a gnarly experience, man. There was this entity that that as we were coming up the stairs, we saw this glow kind of come from one of the upstairs bedrooms. You know, we saw it getting closer. I mean, it was starting to illuminate us. So we shoot out the door and we see this thing coming towards us, and we, you know, kind of screamed. We didn't talk to it or anything, but we were so freaked out that, I mean, and this was back when, you know, 10-year-olds could sneak out at night and it wasn't like a weird thing, you know, like we were having a sleepover and we just decided to skip out, you know, like, so we were only like 2 or 3 blocks from my house, you know, so, and we all lived in the same apartment complex, so it wasn't that big a deal. But we came screaming back. Dude, it was like an 80s movie. Like, mm-hmm. we were, like, it was crazy. But the weird thing was that me and my one friend, who I won't, you know, drop anything on him right now, but we were the ones who, we wanted to talk about it. And then our two other friends didn't. They basically spent the whole time convincing themselves that it didn't happen, you know? And obviously, there's a fear there as you recall things from when you're younger to expound on it and to kind of fill in the blanks and maybe make it something that wasn't what you saw. But I've spent so many years not walking people through it. Like the most I ever did was in the first chapter of the book. But I've spent more time looking at it and not talking about it that I've been able to keep it very fresh in that respect, you know? So that's the first time I really realized that A, there's something that I can't explain and that is completely different than what's on this plane. And I don't want to not feel it, you know? I just want to understand it.
I think there's a lot of people who use drugs and alcohol as a way to avoid extrasensory experience,
right?
Or who have extrasensory experience, who have no, who feel overwhelmed by it, or who right. can't process it, and so they can't reconcile whatever that sensory experience is with their normal yeah. reality and integrate those two.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Or they experience something, and so they chase certain drugs, chemicals to expand it. So it's almost like the flip side of that coin is like, what do you want to do? Do you want to forget it or do you want to chase it? Do you want to go down the rabbit hole or do you want to fill it in?
You know, sometimes when, I mean, from what I'm understanding, and I know you have also some experience in this, when you have access to something, let's say, that not only is unusual, but is, you know, mocked, ridiculed, and in our culture, for the most part, really not acceptable, right?
Right.
What does that bring up? Kind of, you know, like you kind of walk around the world then like I have something that people not only don't understand, but don't experience. Like what does that feel like?
Corey had to add in his book, he then had to stigmatize zealots and cynics in the process.
Right.
So I'm curious. So I think that kind of leads in.
And the reason I put that is because you're kind of stuck in the middle because you have this thing that you're trying to figure out. And so many people over here either want to deny it, that you're lying or you misheard or it was a collision of sounds and lights that triggered something in your brain. Mm-hmm. Or there's people over here that want to say, oh, there are demons and angels and all of this supernatural stuff that I don't believe in, you know? So being stuck in the middle there, it was almost like my approach to being sober. It's like, I got to figure this out on my own, you know, and do it in a way where it's not going to keep me up at night. I need to just make peace with it.
Well, I'm glad you've made peace with it. You've now made me unable to sleep at night.
I'm sorry.
And I'm going to take up drinking again. I'm not going to sleep anyway. I might as well drink.
Take NyQuil. It's the easy out.
You just put your headphones on. You'll be fine.
I can't.
You'll be fine.
Have you taken that sensory awareness that you obviously have to be aware of other factors around you? And have you looked at all at your own energy field? So, for example, if you were to close your eyes, for example, and try to be aware of your own field as though you would this another entity, but maybe it's not throwing things at you. Can you close your eyes and sort of see or either see or feel your own energy field?
I can feel it. I mean, there are definitely times where I can feel whether it's in the form of like a heat emanating or
be more specific. Y'all are talking like this is just like a normal thing. Tell me what it is. Is it something that just like happens? Like you're like,
he's explaining.
No. I'm saying, does it happen? Like you're going to the bathroom or like you're having sex? Or is it like, if you sit and think, when does it happen? Just any random time?
Yeah. I mean, you just kind of become aware that there's almost like something coming off of you. Like you're almost like there's that peripheral side of your vision. You can almost see the waves, but then you look and you can't, but you're very aware of the fact that you're giving off, I don't know whether it's body thermal units or anything like that, but there's definitely something that is emanating from us. That is one of the reasons why we tend to group with people who we enjoy, because I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the energy is similar. And when people, like you ever been in that situation where you're like, you know what? I don't like that guy. Different energy. You know what I'm
All
saying?
The time, every day with everyone I meet.
No, trust me. I could talk that all day. But yeah, I mean, I'm very aware of it. And I don't know if it's because of emotion or if it's just because of my chemical like makeup, but I definitely know that there's something I give off. I give good energy. Let's put it that way. I guess, you know, it's the only way to say it.
This is like when people say to me that I give the most reasonable explanation of God, right? Like from a rational person, like this is the most, he's like an accidental, you know, like it's not like he's like a hippie with like crystals and like he accidentally came across access to this thing that we don't normally associate, you know, with like a person who sings in Slipknot and writes books and is from Iowa.
I got a lot of dogs in the fire. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about.
He's got a whole cupboard full of crystals just off camera.
I do. I'm just like.
I do want to ask a bit about the artwork on your body. Because I'm curious if this has been, a long progression, or I'm just curious if there's any particular, significance. If you have a theme, if it's been,
I mean, there's a bit. It's almost like an accidental theme. A lot of my pieces are kind of two sides of a coin that deal with duality. They deal with yin and yang, really, without being a yin and yang symbol. You know. My chess piece is actually the sun and the moon. You know, obviously it's the light side and the dark, which deals with the duality of the soul. So a lot of my stuff is kind of like me being stuck in between those polar opposites. And then there's stuff like, you know, I have a tattoo of my wife right here. So it's pretty cool, you know, and she's like a superhero to me. So it's pretty rad. But then I have, you know, I have David Bowie here. Oh. I have Hunter S. Thompson here. I have Heath Ledger here.
Wow.
I mean, I'm just covered in stuff. You know, this This is actually a zombie bite that I actually have.
Oh, got it.
Like right here. And every couple years, I have my tattoo artist spread the disease up a little more, you know, just to creep people out. It's like, he's infected. It's one of them, you know.
What's on your legs?
My legs, I have a tattoo of my late bass player, Paul, as a tribute to him. I have a tattoo of a griffin that I got right after Griffin was born.
Oh, sweet. Corey Taylor, this was so awesome. I mean, I feel very bad that we didn't talk more about your really, really incredible musical life and career. But there are so many parts. Exactly. Like there's so many parts of you that this has just been such a delight. You are so, so fascinating. And I hope we meet in many other iterations because you're super awesome.
I'd love to do this again. This was a blast. I appreciate it.
Season 3. He comes back. We do past life regression for all of us.
Ooh.
We find out what time periods his energy has existed in.
I mean, this is a man I want to literally send to a really good craniosacral therapist and be like, put your hands around this man's energy. Tell me what you see.
All right.
That'll be another
cool.
episode.
All right, we're done.
Scott
here.
Is not convinced we're doing that. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're so welcome, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a story.
I feel like you're teasing me.
Nope. I was in Los Angeles.
It can be scary again.
I was working as a property manager for an apartment complex. We had been there for a few years. It's a 50-unit apartment complex. And this single woman, she was a makeup artist in the industry, moves in. She's in her late 20s probably.
I don't like it.
Super creative artist. And you know, we're friendly with her. She's, you know, like young and hip and sort of we're friendly and see each other passing on the property. After she's been in her apartment for, I don't know, like two, three months, she calls me one day and she says, you know, I have something to ask you, but like, I really don't want you to think I'm crazy. She goes, I think my apartment is haunted. And I say, no, that's not crazy. You know, I haven't experienced anything specifically, but like, what's going on? She goes, I don't know, but I just like feel this weird sensation in my apartment and like, I just can't shake it and I don't know what's going on. And as the good property manager that I am, I'm not very good at like replacing ceiling fans or like fixing broken pipes, but
shocking.
She's like, when she says that, I'm like, you know what? I can help you. So I grab my sage and my incense and I go knocking on her door at, you know, it's like 10:30 on a Saturday morning. And I'm like, let's feel it out. And she's like very thankful. And I light my sage and my incense and I start going around each corner of the house. Apartment.
Who taught you to do that? Like, can you give us some context?
Oh, I will, like, but I'm going to go first. And I start to sort of feel out each section. And I'm lighting the incense and I'm sort of asking that the space be cleared and that only, you know, that which is for her highest good will exist in that space and that everything else be cleared out. That this is her place and that we should move on. And I go through the living room and I go through the kitchen and we go through her bedroom and then we go through, we go through the spare bedroom, which was her office.
But you don't want to tell people why you know how to do this?
I'm going to, but I'm getting to this part first. Oh, okay. And then we go into her bedroom and she's standing in the hallway outside of her bedroom and we get to the last corner of the house and all of a sudden this like extreme cold, this weird sensation just like comes over me and I'm like, oh, that feels weird. And it's totally different feeling than anything else in the house. And I'm like, oh, okay, let's just pause here for a moment. And I like put extra focus and I'm like, whatever this is, isn't supposed to be here. And as I start to like do that, all of a sudden she rushes to the bathroom, vomits out of nowhere. The coldness kind of like goes like a flash, like it shifts. It stops being cold. She comes back. She's like, oh my God, I don't know what happened. We sort of process that together for a little bit. She goes, huh, I feel different now. She's just obviously had a physical purge. And we part our separate ways. And after that, she's like, the place felt totally different to her.
You don't like that story?
I don't like that story. But why don't you, can you tell us just a little bit about why you
think about clearing space?
What I was going to say is, like, how old were you when you learned about Sage and that that's used to clear spaces? I mean, were you 12? Were you 18? Were you 34?
I was 17 when I began to explore the fact that energy, for lack of a better word, I don't like that word because I think it is not encompassing of what it is to have extrasensory perception. But I do believe that we exist in multiple forms. And when I was asking Corey about, like, can he see his energy field, I definitely think that there is, whether it's heat, whether, you know, what did he describe it as? You know, he had a good term for it.
Biothermic.
Yeah, when you get a biothermal scan, you see levels of what is considered energy, heat, movement around
you. And it's molecules. They have different movement.
And so there are layers outside of our physical body that are surrounding us at all times. And I think that those can be out of whack. In my own mindfulness practice, have gone in and sort of just had a visualization and sort of brought my, like, when we think about being centered, what are we talking about? Like, my thoughts are all over the place and I'm sort of all out of whack, and I've brought my thinking to a slower standpoint and brought my energy back together around me. And sort of, you know, when people feel discombobulated, you can feel that.
Don't try and use big words like Corey Taylor.
It's not the sage that clears anything. It's us using that as a tool to say, I'm going to sort of tune in to things that exist that I may not be able to see. I'm fairly fascinated by his visual experience and being able to, like, you know, have a totally different perception of reality than most people have.
I'd like to insert one piece of information here. I really hope people have stuck with us, you know, through this, because I'm going to say the word meridians, because it is, you know, one of the kind of more, I don't want to say relatable, but it's one of the more kind of practical, tangible things that, you know, for thousands of years, Chinese medicine, you know, traditional Chinese medicine has worked from, which it falls into this category of things that people were like, that's bull. Like, Chinese medicine, what's that? You know, because, like, in the Western world, it's like, if I don't have a...
You can't MRI it.
Exactly. You can't. But what we do know, you know, and I'm not going to go into the detail because we just went through a lot, but what we do know is that there are... you know, there are tracts that run along the body that have groupings of neurons and clusters of neurons and all sorts of, you know, receptors that, you know, have families, meaning there's families across your body, meaning a family is, it's like it's grouped together. And what acupuncture does is it operates, and reflexology, you know, to a lesser extent, but yeah, it is targeting energy, chi.
She's using air quotes.
I'm using
here.
Air quotes that moves along and through and around these meridians, and you know what chi, like, there is a scientific kind of understanding of what that chi, what that energy is, and yes, a lot of it is blood flow. And, you know, there's very, very important oxygen that is carried, you know, as part of heme, you know, and hemoglobin and your kind of, you know, circulatory system. It is opening things up with oxygen. And oxygen, you know, when we hear oxygen, it's like, oh, you breathe it. No, it's actually like it's a thing that has atoms that are rotating and revolving in certain ways, and there's a charge to oxygen. It has an ionic presence in your body, and that makes me cry for other reasons, just because the body is amazing. I'll say one more thing about this. As we've talked about, I've had four hernias, and I've been cut twice, hip to hip. And I was shocked when completely Western surgeons that I was working with described to me how they were cutting through meridians. And I was like, oh, meaning it is, it's even making its way into not only Western medicine, but like surgical medicine, which, you know, is some of the most, you know, technical, you know, annoying in some cases, detail-oriented, quantifiable, you know. Yeah, and then, of course, the holistic, you know, healers that I've worked with have been able to find other ways that that cutting, you know, has interrupted, you know, blood flow, like all those things. And I also, you know, I have a section that I can't feel. Anyway, I have so many things to say, but that was incredible. And I cried because it made me very uncomfortable. And I was looking up, why am I crying when I'm scared?
Why,
what is that?
Why are you crying when you're scared? Why are you scared?
I don't know. It's very scary.
Is it scary because you can't quantify it? Your science brain is unsure of it. It feels overwhelming. It feels unpredictable.
I mean, you know, one of the reasons people cry is because it releases cortisol.
Yeah, but why are you crying? So I don't like horror movies at all. I don't like being scared, but I'm not scared by this. So I guess where I'm going is asking you to push a little further and say, why is it that a conversation about extrasensory... Okay, but what is it that you like? Is it that it's unpredictable? Is it that it's...
Oh, I think it's like that it exists. Like, it creeps me out. It, like, a little bit makes me feel like, am I going crazy? I go to the hospital now. that's what it feels like. Like what if there are... Yeah, it's like there's a lot of what if and like...
It opens up a Pandora's box for you.
No, it's not... it's not even the Pandora's box. It's just like... It feels almost like, what if I found out that like my parents weren't my parents? It feels like so removed from things that are comfortable.
That's a Pandora's box, isn't it? It's just I'm using Pandora's box wrong. Maybe. I mean, it's like
maybe
you're
they didn't have mythology in Toronto.
You're basically exposing the matrix. You're showing that you could be living in
a
reality that is not fully formed.
And that right, and that makes me yes, and the fact that
or fully understood.
Right. The fact that it is so far outside of like, yes, not just my scientific knowledge, like our understanding of the world, very scary, but also not dissimilar from like when I find something out like that the government's been lying to us about something, I get that it makes me feel jittery and unstable.
If anyone listening has had an extrasensory experience, let us know at Bialik Breakdown on Instagram. Send us a message or... post and tag us. We're very curious.
And also, friendly reminder that Slipknot, they're going to tour. I mean, now I feel like I need to see him in concert because I need to see. Maybe I become his biggest fan. And then I start stalking him and he gets scared. And we don't joke about stalking. Their Knotfest Roadshow begins in Fargo, North Dakota, March 16th. Also a reminder to check out Corey's new solo album, CMFB... Sides. Gosh, from our paranormal breakdown to the one we hope you never have, or maybe that you do have if you're okay with that sort of thing and it doesn't make you cry. We'll see you next time.
It's Maya Bialik's breakdown. She's going to break it down for you. She's got a neuroscience PhD or two. One fiction, one fact. And now she's going to break down. It's a breakdown. She's going to break it down.